what we're looking forward to is healthy Christmas eating. So welcome my guest, Dr. Fred Harvey, internist and gerontologist and member of the American Board of Holistic Physicians. Good morning, Dr. Harvey.
Good morning.
Okay, let's push all the magic buttons here and see if we can make your voice happen. Go ahead.
Mic number three.
Okay, let's see. Well, we got them all turned up. Let's try another microphone. And so that's why they call this amateur radio. I got a live mic right there. So I don't know what number it is, but it's happening. If you ever want to be a programmer here at WSLR, you can learn how to push all these buttons and move all these slides on the board and have them work sometimes and then sometimes not. So
this seems to work. Good morning, everybody.
Okay. Good morning, Dr. Harvey. Why don't you just keep talking a minute while I play with these buttons?
1, 2, 3, 4. This. No, that's
there we go. We got it. You're on mic four.
All right.
So that means that you could be on the radio with us because we have two other microphones.
Yes. they don't work right now.
It would be nice if we could get them to work. Merry Christmas, Dr. Harvey.
And to you.
So what's up for you for Christmas?
Oh, I'm having the old family over to my house.
Uh-huh. So you're the cook?
I'm going to do the bird, and I have mom and cousins cooking up all kinds of good things to bring by.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the bird really is the place for us to start because there's such a clear difference between the intake of red meat and the intake of white meat. You know, I never really have vibed on to that language because pork is white and salmon is red. But,
yeah,
you know, I still go with the Native Americans' definition of two legs and four legs. The four-legged animals are what we often call the red meat, and the two-legged animals with feathers are often what we call the white meat. But there is no question that the intake of white meat makes a very different set of compounds in the digestive tract.
That's true.
The large intestine is much more likely to get inflammation from high intakes of red meat like beef. It doesn't happen when we have high intakes of white meat like turkey. And these nitroso compounds that get created in the bowel are a contributor to colon cancer. And so we know the higher the amount of four-legged animals that people eat, the higher the amount of digestive tract issues. And so that's one of the reasons that I'm a big endorser of the use of chicken and turkey and duck and quail and all of them birds. Or like when I visited Egypt when they had pigeon.
Pigeon.
And I thought, oh, that's an interesting name. And then I went, oh, yeah, pigeon.
That's a really pigeon. Interesting thing. I tried it. I tried to do it once. My grandfather took me hunting, and we got about 4 pigeon. And so he set me about cleaning them. And
did that cure you from wanting to eat pigeons?
Well, I never got the skin off, so I never figured out how to actually do it. I was like 10, and just it didn't happen, and we never ate pigeon, and it never happened again.
Well, you know, a lot of times people badmouth duck, which some people will have for Christmas, because they say, oh, that's really fatty. But, you know, with duck, you're really fortunate, because that fat sits right under the skin, right above that breast, and
yes.
So it bathes and bastes the breast as it cooks. It's pretty sweet. But you know, I always have to look at the nature of the fact that white meat turkey, white turkey breast has one of the highest protein values per ounce of any meat we can eat. So people that need to make sure that they get adequate protein are definitely going to do a whole lot better with 7 to 9 grams an ounce in turkey versus 1 gram in bacon.
Yes.
And what we see now is a very big change in the quality of the turkey meat, depending on what the turkeys are fed. And that seems so obvious that, you know, if you gave the bird high quality feed, you would make higher quality meat. But a lot of people don't realize that those bargain turkeys have been fed bargain food. And as a result, the flesh itself actually changes. We had a letter in on one of the shows that I was on WMNF over Thanksgiving that one of the listeners had cooked a turkey and that the texture of it was really weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that can be affected by what we actually feed the birds. So we actually change the constituents of the fats that are in the bird based on whether we feed them well. And now that they've started feeding turkeys good oils like flax oil and fish oil and coconut oil, what they found out is that coconut oil, because it contains caprylic acid, is actually lowering the infection rate of Campylobacter and Salmonella bacteria, which permeates turkeys all over the United States.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I just came back from a conference last weekend, and one of the things they mentioned about, we were talking about detoxification, which is totally gut and liver dependent, you can completely alter the biome, the group of bacteria that live in your gut, by altering the fat that you take in. Because some of these fats are antibiotic or antifungal, like caprylic acid. It will actually change the milieu in your gut beneficially and make the allow the good bacteria to grow better and inhibit the bad bacteria and yeast.
So what are the oils that we shouldn't eat, the ones that we should keep low in the diet because they alter our gut in a bad way?
Well, trans fats, the ones that are altered by high heat processing, like in white margarines and things like that, and saturated fats from the red meat, the four-leggeds, the big, you know, bacon is the wrong kind of fat to put into your gut.
But the day after Christmas, when everybody has that turkey left over, they want a bacon, lettuce, and tomato and turkey club.
How about turkey bacon?
There you go. We could start there. But we have to understand that there are multiple studies that indicate that there are risk differences between eating these light white meats and eating those deep red meats.
There's another thing about that texture that your friend or your listener might have had, and that is the many of these turkeys are actually adulterated. They're not just turkey. You know, I don't want to use a brand name, but there's one that it's a ball and they inject butter into it.
Uh-huh.
And it's not really butter. It's this stuff that has got all kinds of chemicals. And so when you alter the meat by injecting these like rotisserie type chemicals to make it a juicier, tastier bird, you're actually damaging it.
Well, and the thing that people don't realize sometimes is that deli turkey meat and turkey are not exactly the same thing.
Right.
That with deli turkey meat, it's not uncommon for them to be soaked in a brine that contains sugar and salt and spices, and the meat takes that up.
Right.
And when it takes that up, then they can sell you sweet, salty water for $6 a pound.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what's happened. That's why, if you ever notice when you eat deli turkey meat, it's gooshy.
Sometimes it is, yes.
Yeah. And that gooshy texture, I mean, it's exactly the opposite. When you roast a turkey, it ends up, you know, potentially getting too dry.
Right.
And so that's one of the spotters that you can have. But, you know, I want to talk, Dr. Harvey, about the nature of tryptophan. You know, there's so much confusion in the media when they talk about the fact that, oh, turkey is high in tryptophan, and that's why you fall asleep on the sofa after you've had your Thanksgiving and Christmas meal. But we know that that's not really true.
That is just not true.
Well, there's the same amount of tryptophan, that's an amino acid, in shrimp and tuna and snapper and halibut and chicken and lamb and beef and salmon. All of them have the same amount of tryptophan that turkey does. So let's talk about tryptophan and what it does.
Well, tryptophan is an amino acid, so it's one of the foundational building blocks of proteins. But tryptophan, in the sense that we're talking about, is actually a precursor to a neurotransmitter. It's the building block that you make serotonin and melatonin from. And so since we make melatonin from tryptophan, many people think that from eating turkey, which is, it's got a nice amount of tryptophan, they'll go to sleep because the body will then produce melatonin, the sleep chemical from tryptophan in the food. However, there is a problem there. tryptophan and most of the amino acids have no way of getting into the brain without a transport mechanism. So if you eat tryptophan alone, in a pill form, you might be able to get a really good brain level of the tryptophan to make melatonin. So it's good to take tryptophan therapeutically on an empty stomach. But when you mix it in with a meal and the fats and the sugars and all the other proteins are in there and all the other amino acids, it's a delayed absorption, so you get lower blood levels. And then all the amino acids have to wait in line at the brain transport mechanism, at the blood-brain barrier, trying to get in. So tryptophan just waits in line. You get little bits of it with all the other ones. So it really never produces like a chemical effect that we're looking for to make sleep happen.
Well, and the other thing about it is, you know, the pineal gland is the place that tryptophan turns into melatonin, or serotonin turns into melatonin.
Right.
And the pineal gland is very much regulated by light. And so what happens is, as the evening gets darker and darker, that messaging signal to the pineal gland says, oh, it's getting dark, it's time to go to sleep, I'll start the manufacturing plant for melatonin now. And then the second that light comes up, the whether you have the night light in the bathroom and you get up to toilet in the middle of the night and you look at that night light, then your pineal gland thinks the sun is coming up, and it switches off that mechanism to make melatonin. And so that's one of the reasons that I suggest that people sleep in an eye mask and sleep in the darkest bedroom possible.
Yes.
You know, when people say, well, I have to get up in the middle of the night to toilet, and I say, well, blind people make it to the bathroom without having to have, you know, a nightlight, so you can learn how to find your way from your bed to your bathroom.
Yes.
Because one candle power is all it takes for the pineal gland to recognize that the sun is coming up and to switch off melatonin. So if you actually wanted to increase melatonin, of course you could take a melatonin pill, and you don't need very much of it. You know, when I have somebody come in the clinic that says, I've tried melatonin for insomnia and it didn't work, what I have to tell them is, then the problem wasn't melatonin in the first place, because
that's right.
Melatonin supplementation only works if you're melatonin deficient.
That's true. So the fact that melatonin production turns off when there's light would actually be the evidence there that the turkey meal is not what induces sleep. Because I know many of you out there have had a big noontime holiday feast and fallen asleep by 2 o'clock. And so it's not melatonin production that's doing this.
Right. And, you know, the use of tryptophan as a supplement, you know, fell into disfavor about 17 years ago when one contaminated batch from one factory in Japan made it to the United States, and it caused horrible, horrible health effects for a number of individuals who got a hold of that single batch from a single lab. And there was a period of time where tryptophan supplementation was banned.
That's right.
But now we use tryptophan. I use it very regularly in my practice. And I also use the agent that is one step between tryptophan and serotonin, which is called 5-HTP. Tryptophan can turn into a lot of things in your body. One of the things that it can create is niacin, as an example. It doesn't just make serotonin and melatonin. But when you get a hold of 5-HTP, which is properly called 5-hydroxytryptophan, it's one step closer to serotonin. So I use it in my practice in the treatment of depression. I use it in the treatment for individuals who are not depressed, but who are overwhelmed by their life.
Yes, overwhelm is a really good target
yep.
for that. Because we call serotonin the harmonizer. It makes your life just a bit more harmonious. So it may reduce your anxieties and just that overwhelm feeling and lift your mood a bit.
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. And if, in fact, you're deficient in melatonin, serotonin will go on to produce melatonin and thereby help you sleep.
Right.
So taking 100 milligrams or 200 milligrams of 5-HTP 30 minutes before bed or right at bedtime, if you don't have any trouble falling asleep, may actually enhance your sleep and your mood at the same time. So we got all kinds of reasons to buy a turkey, but I sure want them to try to buy a certified organic turkey.
That would be great. even the first level of organic care, just eliminating the hormones and the antibiotics and let the birds be outside for a while is a great step in good care.
Well, it's mostly the antibiotics, because in the United States, we don't give hormones to fowl.
That's right.
So hormones are all on the four-legged side. But the thing that I want to remind all the listeners about is don't think you have to go to a health food store to get an organic turkey. Most people believe that the only place they can get an organic turkey is at the health food store, but in fact, they were at every major market this last Thanksgiving here in Sarasota. And so if you're somebody that you got a small household and you say, well, I can't possibly use a whole turkey, well, you can always buy a turkey and get the butcher to saw it in half. And then you take half of it and stick it in the freezer and, you know, fix it for another day.
Or you could just do a turkey breast.
But if they buy a turkey breast, I always want to remind them, buy the turkey breast with the skin intact.
Yes.
If you get the skin intact, it will help to keep the turkey breast from drying out while you're cooking, and then you can remove the skin after it's cooked. And for those of you that are going to go all the way to the bottom of the list and you're just going to make yourself a turkey burger for Christmas Day, I would simply remind you that ground turkey varies remarkably in terms of its quality. When I went to the store a couple of months ago and did one of my grocery inspections, I found ground turkey that had as much as 45% fat in it.
Oh my.
And we think of turkey as being really low fat.
Like 97% lean.
Yeah, right. But it was 45% fat. And at the exact same store, in the exact same cabinet, I found a ground turkey that was only 14% fat. So it was a remarkable difference in quality.
That's
because
amazing.
Some places, you know, it ends up looking an awful lot like pink paste. You know, I always warn people about pink paste, that stuff that's made out of leftover chickens and such that gets turned into nuggets and chicken fingers that we feed our children.
I just wonder where they found 45% fat turkey. It's not that fatty a bird.
What they do is they grind up all of the skin.
Oh.
And all of the skin, all of the grizzle, all of the rest of the stuff goes into
pink paste.
Pink paste. And so it's just making people aware of the fact that there is a difference. Turkey is one of the healthiest meats. You know, there really aren't a lot of individual studies about turkey. It's sort of been lumped in with the rest of poultry. But I'm going to put it pretty high on the list.
It really is. I mean, it's got just the right amount of fat in it that actually gives you that fullness factor. When you're eating it, it actually chickens a little bit more lean. You need a little bit of fat to actually satiate the hunger. And then it also will help delay some of the absorption. So you have a slower absorption of your meal, and it just allows you to assimilate the calories that much easier and that much better to put it through your liver in a more slow fashion.
Well, I think that the popularity of turkey has gone up a lot, but I still have to remind people of safety.
Yes.
There will be phone calls that will happen in my clinic on Monday morning of people who have diarrhea because they have exposed themselves to the Campylobacter and Salmonella. 75% of all the turkeys in the United States are infected with Campylobacter.
Wow.
And so when you take that raw turkey out and you put it on the kitchen counter, now you've got Campylobacter bacteria on the kitchen counter.
That's right.
And, you know, I just want to say, be smart, be safe in the handling of any raw meat, as far as your countertop, your cutting board, because cross-contamination happens easily. And I don't think a Christmas has gone by that I haven't seen a couple of cases of food poisoning the day after in my clinic. And so one of the things that we want to do to protect ourselves from that is add the cranberries.
There you go.
Because the cranberries have so many activities against bacteria adhering. You know, we've heard about cranberry juice with urinary tract infections for years. And they thought for a very long time that the reason that cranberries were beneficial was simply because of the fact that they were very acidic. And so their acidic quality changed the pH of the urine. And that was what inhibited bacterial growth. But it turns out that's not true. In fact, that's not true at all. What's actually true is that the agents in cranberry keep bacteria from hooking on to the wall of the urethral tube and perhaps even the bladder. And so preventing the attachment of bacteria takes us right to the stomach, because now it's been demonstrated that cranberries can stop the adherence of Helicobacter pylori in the stomach.
Yeah, it's a really amazing property. I don't know what how exactly it does, but they've shown that it prevents the mucosa, the lining of all of your wet skin, essentially, has a very similar property. And bacteria love to live on that wet skin because they like moist environments. And all of that wet skin is covered with mucus, mucosa. And that matrix is what they live in. And the acids, the organic acids that are in the cranberry actually prevent that from happening. It could be that it polarizes the mucus better, or just attaches to the bacteria in a certain way that prevents them from getting in there, but it is an amazing fruit.
Well, you know, one of my favorite words on the entire planet is proanthocyanidin. I don't know why I love that word, proanthocyanidin.
That's a great word.
I just love that word. And that is or PACs. You know, everybody's got to abbreviate everything. PACs, proanthocyanidins. Those are the things that prevent the UTIs, the urinary tract infections. They're the ones that have these very special linkages between their components that act as a barrier to keep bacteria from latching on. So if somebody's had H. pylori, H. pylori is the bacteria that we now know causes about 80 to 90% of all stomach ulcers. And so for years we thought ulcers were caused because somebody was nervous. But in fact, an Australian scientist demonstrated the fact that these bacteria, these Helicobacter pylori bacteria, or H. pylori bacteria, actually are the cause of gastritis and ulceration happening in the stomach. And so I always recommend broccoli, 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 and broccoli, because broccoli contains that magic ingredient sulforaphane that keeps those bacteria from doing their damage and actually can kill them directly. But now we're going to add cranberry juice. So that smoothie with cranberry juice and broccoli, I don't know if it's going to popularize, Dr. Harvey, but it sure would protect the stomach.
That it would. We're not going to be drinking cranberry juice with a turkey, more than likely, but cranberry sauce, cranberry relish?
Well, and whole cranberries really have a huge, big advantage. You know, the cranberry sauce, which is nothing more than cranberry jelly, essentially, we got lots of sugar in there, and we know it's delicious. I love it, and I love it on that turkey sandwich the day after.
Very tasty.
Cranberry and some beautiful crispy lettuce. Yum.
I like a little tarragon mayonnaise with that.
Ooh, I'll try that one this year.
It's tasty.
That sounds good. But whole cranberries, when they are consumed, do a better job in protecting our cardiovascular system and our liver. There are several groups of researchers who've summarized all of these cranberry health benefits, but the synergy of these various anthocyanins and anthocyanidins and phenolic acids and flavonoids and triterpenoids, all of those things go together in the whole cranberries.
Let me just say that sentence again fast.
Well, we'll start with triterpenoids, you know, ursalic acid. I mean, you wake up in the morning and say, I'd like a nice glass of ursalic acid.
Absolutely.
You know, every day. And so when we realize that this is beneficial for the heart, it's got anti-cancer properties in it. We've got mechanisms of action that are going on in cranberries that are really remarkable. And what's true is we can take all little teeny tiny fruits. And little teeny tiny fruits have a lot more skin to pulp ratio. Think of that as compared to, say, a honeydew melon or a watermelon.
Right.
So when we have a lot of skin, like blueberries and cranberries and raspberries and blackberries, in relation to the amount of pulp, we always have very high antioxidant levels. And whether they're phenolic compounds or flavonoid compounds or any of the other families of antioxidants, the higher the amount of skin to pulp, the higher the amount of antioxidants. The deeper the color, the higher the amount of antioxidants. So with cranberries, we win on both counts.
There's a little alternative to the cranberry, too. If you're Scandinavian, you might know about the lingonberry, which is actually a little bit smaller than the cranberry, so it actually has a higher skin-to-pulp ratio. It's pretty tasty, too.
I found them in the market one time in my entire life.
I've never found them fresh.
I found them fresh one time in Colorado, and I remember I bought every box they had at that particular time.
I just saw that you can order them online from Alaska, wild.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. But cranberries, you have to be serious here, though. Who's going to be eating whole cranberries with their turkey?
Well,
this season.
You know, lately we've been seeing more of the throwing a little bit of fruit into the salad. You know, we started out with a little mandarin oranges in the spinach salad, and then we started seeing some dried cranberries show up with the pine nuts and the blue cheese as that got hipper.
Yes.
And so that's one of the places that I'm seeing cranberries starting to show up is you could just take a tablespoon of them and throw them onto the salad.
Dried.
Yeah,
or dried or fresh.
But the idea is that when we, you know, a lot of the regular listeners of No Nonsense Nutrition know that I espouse the idea of fruit, eat it alone or leave it alone.
Right.
The exception that I make to that are these high acid, low sugar fruits like cranberries and blueberries. If you throw a tablespoon of blueberries into your salad, that does not cause the reactive process in the bowel of gas that we see when people eat a piece of fresh fruit with a meal.
Right.
So those
or,
are
or
one
after
of the
a meal. Fruit for dessert is not a really good idea either. But as this, as a condiment, it's a wonderful thing. And I was just contrasting cranberry sauce, you know, the jellied, high sugar, low skin. We actually generally filter the skin out of that, so it's a smooth treat, versus the cranberry relish, where you take the whole cranberries and just boil them yourself with maybe a bit of orange juice or some other citrus juice and then some sugar. And at that point, you can actually alter the sugar content and use other alternatives to make it less high glycemic, lower glycemic, by cutting back the sugar and adding some stevia or using some agave or some other natural sweetener instead of the solid white sugar. And so you'll reduce the glycemic load and actually keep it fairly healthy. Add some citrus rind in, and you add a bunch of new flavonoids and terpenoids and other kinds of really good antioxidants, which would augment the effect of the cranberry.
Well, as far as the healthy way of eating, we have to realize that health-promoting antioxidants are going to show up in cranberries really right at the top of the list. And so when we talk about the anti-cancer properties, there's all kinds of mechanisms of action that take place that are anti-cancer or cancer preventative benefits that happen, especially to the breast, the colon, the lung, and the prostate from cranberries. These antioxidants and other mechanisms that are in the cranberries block some of the inflammatory enzymes and inhibit a certain liver enzyme, a phase one detoxification enzyme. They help to trigger apoptosis, which is cell death. So the thing that we need to understand is we look at cranberry sauce a couple of times a year as a novelty on the table. And what's true is we should bring cranberries into our life on a very regular basis. And now is the time of the year to buy them and stick them in the freezer. They're fresh from October till December. We don't see them fresh much for the rest of the year. So put your stash of cranberries away now, because from the familiar benefits like vitamin C and fiber to these very exotic benefits, hydroxybenzoic acid, vanillic acid, cinnamic, turmeric, you know, all of those things, we're not going to find a better choice. In addition to its protection against repetitive UTIs, urinary tract infections, it's very difficult for E. coli and other bacteria to latch on to that lining in the bladder and the urethra if we've got cranberry in there regularly. And at the health food store, you can find cranberry concentrate. It's not fresh cranberries, and it's not cranberry juice or cranberry sauce. It's just cranberry concentrate. It's pretty tart.
Mm-hmm.
But you can put a tablespoon of it in a glass of water, and you can make a much better urinary tract infection protector. And don't forget that these same protectors are beneficial for those of you that have issues with your gums. If you're one of the individuals that's had periodontal disease, don't hesitate to take a half a dozen cranberries and crunch them up. Yeah, they're going to be a little bit sour. But the thing is that when you crunch them up, those compounds in the cranberries are actually going to get into those little pockets in your mouth and help to stop the activity of the periodontal disease. So from lowering cold and flu risks to cardiac benefits, cranberries run pretty high on my list in terms of one of the Christmas foods that we need to have a little bit more respect for.
And even consider it outside the Christmas season.
Outside all the time. Nothing like a glossy scarlet red tart berry to make your day. But you know, the other thing, Dr. Harvey, that we're going to see on that Christmas table for a whole lot of individuals is going to be sweet potatoes.
Oh, yes.
And before the show aired, we were having a little conversation about the difference between sweet potatoes and yams. Because over and over again, I go to the market and I see these things that are called yams, but I'm here to tell you, as a botanist, they aren't yams. We're not going to find yams in the United States. So it doesn't matter whether they say garnet yams or any other kind of yams. What's true is they are all batatas.
Sweet potatoes, huh?
That's the one. And so whether sweet potatoes have white flesh, yellow flesh, orange flesh that we're most familiar with, or purple flesh, they are all sweet potatoes. These orange flesh sweet potatoes are one of nature's best sources of beta carotene. And beta carotene is a natural carotenoid, and it changes into vitamin A in the liver. If you have a deficiency of vitamin A, beta carotene will become vitamin A. But if you don't have a deficiency of vitamin A, beta carotene will stay beta carotene, which is an antioxidant and has remarkable benefits to the body.
Yeah, beta carotene is critical for cancer prevention, eye health, heart health. The carotenoids are, and for skin health, all your skin. I use higher doses of vitamin A to support people that have had an upper respiratory or going through an upper respiratory infection because it really does help your skin regenerate.
Well, and I use fairly high doses of vitamin A for people who have dry eye.
Yes. Yes.
25,000 IUs of vitamin A for 30 days, I usually see a difference in dry eye. Well, a lot of these people, when I look at their food diary, there are no gold, orange, red foods in their diary.
Right.
And so those gold, orange, red foods are the ones that mostly have beta carotene.
Or now, even green foods. It's very interesting because behind that green, chlorophyll is such an intensely dark pigment that it covers up the lighter reds, yellows, and oranges. But if you think about it, in the fall, in autumn, what happens to the leaves? They turn red, orange, yellow after the green goes. And so behind that, in all of your green leafy vegetables, spinach is very high in beta carotene.
Broccoli,
all of them have great yellows. If you notice the broccoli sat in your fridge, it would start to turn yellow.
So that beta carotene, orange flesh sweet potatoes, the highest source that we can get our hands on. And so in order for you to appreciate this, you want to appreciate that distinction. Beta carotene is not vitamin A. I will get clients that will come in the clinic on a pretty regular basis. I just had one of these last week. And they look at a bottle of multivitamins that, you know, we're reading labels.
Yes.
And it says 20,000 IUs of beta carotene. And they go, oh, I can't take that much vitamin A. My doctor told me if I take that much vitamin A, my hip will break.
Oh, Lord.
And I said, your doctor doesn't know the difference between beta carotene and vitamin A? What is my first recommendation? Switch doctors.
Switch doctors, exactly.
Because there is a huge difference between vitamin A and beta carotene.
You have to give a little bit of leeway there because the labeling can be misleading because it will say vitamin A as X amount of beta carotene and X amount of vitamin A. And, you know, that looks like all vitamin A because they just put it there up front, but well, it's really not vitamin
that's
A.
That's true. They do list it under vitamin A, but that's the distinction we want you, the educated listener of WSLR, to understand, that beta carotene only becomes vitamin A if your body needs more vitamin
A.
It's
next to impossible to get toxic in beta carotene.
Yeah,
I've
right.
had many glowing yellow people that are beta carotene, like the 8-carat juiced once a day glass of carrot juice, that will turn you yellow, but it's not going to make you toxic.
Right. Well, and that's only going to happen to a few people that don't have the ability to convert it very well.
Right.
It's not going to be very common. But in order for you to get that great beta carotene out of your sweet potatoes, you got to have some fat with the sweet potatoes at the same time. I talked to one of my clients that lives over in Tampa, and she says, I said, I want you to saute this. And she says, oh, I never saute. I always steam all my vegetables. And I said, yeah, but you're not getting the benefit unless you put a little bit of butter on it. You're not getting the benefit unless you saute it in a little bit of olive oil. So you can go ahead and steam your sweet potatoes, but you won't get anywhere near as much flavor out of them as if you bake them.
Yes.
The nature of the mechanism that happens in slowly cooking a sweet potato brings out its sweetness. Doing 5 minutes in the microwave is nothing like doing 50 minutes in the oven as far as the taste of a sweet potato.
Totally different product.
And so, yeah, you may want to hurry the sweet potato along by sticking it in the microwave for 2 minutes before you put it in the oven so that you can cut the cooking time down
to all the time.
20 or 30 minutes. But the nutritional benefits from sweet potatoes won't be achieved if you steam or boil them as your cooking method. The preservation of the anthocyanins are there with steaming, but the roasting, the baking and the roasting, not only has better blood sugar effects in terms of lowering the glycemic index, and that's surprising because they're sweeter.
Right.
They're sweeter to taste. But these special peroxide enzymes that are in the sweet potato end up being deactivated with long amounts of slow cooking. And the natural anthocyanin extracts, the very ones that we use for food coloring and natural food coloring, come out as a result of slow cooking. So that's always the advantage with sweet potatoes.
And an alternative for your fat content there would be to drizzle your baked sweet potato with a little coconut oil.
Oh, no question. That sounds delicious. I like steaming them and then refrying them in a little bit of coconut oil.
Oh, yeah. If I have leftover baked potatoes or sweet potatoes, they often end up in the pan with some onions and some other taste treats.
Well, the real good news here is the anti-inflammatory nutrients in the sweet potato. Now, that's not going to happen if you coat your sweet potato with brown sugar and marshmallows. I'm sorry.
Well, you still get some of those antioxidants. However, you might counteract the effect.
Well, it's just, you know, do you want to eat dessert before you eat dessert? You know?
Right.
And that's what happens when we load them up with pecans. We're going to get those, you know, fats present in the
yes.
sweet potato. But by the time the brown sugar and the marshmallows, I'm not saying you can't use a little. I like to put a little maple syrup on mine personally.
Yes.
But, you know, we don't want to undo the benefit that we just got. And the big benefit is the anti-inflammatory effects. In addition to the beta carotene, these color-related pigments that are in the sweet potato provide anti-inflammatory effects. And what's very hip is the way that they activate a whole series of compounds. And I'll not belabor the names of the compounds because, well, we just don't need to. But the thing that I think is the most interesting about these compounds that are anti-inflammatory in sweet potatoes is their impact on fibrinogen. Fibrinogen is a glycoprotein that the body has to use for successful blood clotting. And you might think that blood clotting is a bad thing. Well, certainly it is when we're talking about a stroke or a deep vein thrombosis. But what's true is that we need a coagulation factor like thrombin and fibrinogen. And those things get converted when you have a bleeding injury. And so they help to close off wounds. They help to stop the loss of blood. But these clot-related molecules can pose various kinds of health risks. And so we don't want excess amounts of fibrinogen or fibrin in our bloodstream. This is not a good thing. Too much fibrin in the central nervous system has been associated with the breakdown of the myelin sheath in MS. So when we use sweet potato, we lessen the excess amount of fibrinogen or fibrin. And this can give us incredible anti-inflammatory effects as far as the bloodstream is concerned.
Yeah, that's the thing. These wonderful antioxidants and cyanins and all the chemicals in the sweet potato actually are anti-inflammatory. That's what we're looking for here, because inflammation is the source of all of our degenerative diseases, like the stroke and the heart attack. When we get inflammation, we'll increase the fibrinogen and increase the thickness of the blood, thus setting up a potential clot to happen. And so foods like sweet potatoes will reduce that inflammation, reduce the levels of the fibrinogen, and make your blood a little bit more fluid, less sticky, so that you don't end up with a problem.
Yeah, it's like when I talk about fish oil, I say it's like making greased frisbees in your blood. As far as the platelets are concerned, they just slide by each other.
Exactly.
And it's kind of the same thing that happens with sweet potato. So whether it's white or whether it's gold, whether it's yellow or whether it's purple, remember, it's not a yam. It's a sweet potato. And I think the other thing that's going to be on most of America's plates are going to be green beans. You know, we don't usually think of green beans providing us with important, colorful pigments. But there's lutein, beta-carotene, there's violansins, there's zeaxanthin in green beans. All these different carotenoids are comparable to carotenoid-rich vegetables like carrots and tomatoes. The reason that we don't see these carotenoids is because that concentrated chlorophyll content of green beans and the amazing shade of green that it provides, you don't see these carotenoids that are underneath the green. You know, if you're unable to obtain fresh green beans, you can still get plenty of them from green beans that have been frozen, and even though it pains me, even from green beans that have been canned.
But the frozen ones even have, for a half a cup serving, have 752 international units of vitamin A. That's 15% of your daily value in a half a cup of green
beans. Well, again, as beta-carotene.
As beta-carotene, right. Right, and even they even have 56 milligrams of calcium in a half cup. So a cup of green beans gives you over 100 milligrams of calcium to support your bone health.
But if you take those green beans and you put cream of mushroom soup on them, and then put the canned French fried onions on top of that, you have lost all of the health benefits of the green beans. Why do we have to dress up every vegetable with slime in order to put it on the holiday table? What we want to do is just steam some green beans.
And they're fabulous.
Toss them with a little coconut oil or a little butter or a little olive oil, and you don't have to do anything else to them. You don't have to muck them up in
it's
order
really true.
To,
it's really true.
To put them on the table.
I had this discussion with my mother for Thanksgiving because she's gluten sensitive and dairy sensitive, and she wanted to make green bean casserole. And I just said, why? Why would you do that for one day a year when you know it's torture for your gut? It doesn't make any sense. So she backed down, and actually I found online a recipe. I just Googled up dairy-free, gluten-free green bean casserole, and it turned out to be the most fabulous thing. There was nothing left. Everybody just chowed down on this
stuff. I want that recipe.
I will get it to you, and it's really pretty simple. But if you'd Google gluten-free, dairy-free green bean casserole,
that's
you should
all it
be
takes.
Able to find it. But it's I made a from scratch cream of cashew-based mushroom soup mix, and the crispy onions on the top were toasted almond flour tossed in, or actually I tossed very thin sliced caramelized red onions in with the toasted almond flour, and that went on top. It was delightful.
So the real question is, did Mother love it?
Everybody did.
Oh,
everybody.
That's great. But, you know, we don't think of green beans for cardiovascular benefits. We don't realize that there is alpha-linoleic acid, which is one of the omega-3 fatty acids.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Alpha lipoic acid shows up in green beans. The amount is actually fairly high in comparison to the amount of calories. You get, at least get a milligram of alpha lipoic acid.
Alpha linoleic or alpha lipoic?
Alpha linoleic acid in every green bean that you eat. So it's not as concentrated as something like walnuts, but the idea is even from the vegetable kingdom, we're getting ALA or alpha linoleic acid, the same thing we find in flax.
I didn't get to this part of the page yet, but I just looked at it. There's actually more omega-3 fats in green beans than there are omega-6 fats.
Yeah, right.
10 milligrams or 15 milligrams more.
There are other strong carotenoid and flavonoid benefits, but fundamentally what happens with green beans is it reduces the production of cox and lox, and these are not fishes and hens. These are inflammatory compounds. Lipooxygenases and cyclooxygenases are inflammatory compounds. And you probably heard of Vioxx and Celebrex being a COX-2 inhibitor. Well, I'm here to tell you that green beans are a COX-2 inhibitor. And so it absolutely reduces inflammation.
We did not get to your favorite class of vegetables yet.
What's that?
Brassicas.
Okay, we'll talk about our brassica buddies.
Well, on almost every holiday table that I've been at my family, we have coleslaw.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've never had coleslaw for Christmas.
Really?
Now, I've had Brussels sprouts for Christmas.
I've done that, too.
Yeah, roasted Brussels sprouts were part of my grandmother's Christmas ritual.
Yeah, my family didn't do that, but my Aunt Viola made the absolute best coleslaw. And I looked forward to being at her house for Christmas dinner.
Well, you know, I'm a huge coleslaw queen. I mean, I would eat coleslaw every single solitary day.
Yes.
But I actually never thought about it for Christmas.
I just love that cool, cool flavor next to the meat. It's just such a good thing. So,
how does Aunt Viola make it?
She actually is no longer with us. Diabetes took her about 15 years ago. But she used, I believe, the Miracle Whip with a little bit of extra sugar and vinegar in it. And that was basically her coleslaw dressing.
So how do you do it?
I do it the same way because I loved her recipe. Shredded cabbage, a little bit of grated onion, just a very little bit of grated onion just for that flavor. I don't like chunks of it, and I can't stand the green pepper in it, as I know you
can.
So basically it's cabbage, a little bit of onion flavor, salt, pepper, and the Miracle Whip coleslaw dressing.
Well, I'm going to up your ante here. I'm still a fan of the $8 a jar organic mayonnaise.
There you go.
You know, there's a part of my wallet that screams in my pocketbook every time I buy it. But if I'm going to put fats in the body, I want to make sure that they're the best fats I can get my hands on.
I have it on the shelf.
And
safflower oil.
And so when I buy that, you know, fancy $8 or $9 a quart organic mayonnaise, I take one part of the mayonnaise, a half a part of honey, and a half a part of brown rice vinegar.
Mm.
And that's my combination. So I'm using, instead of regular vinegar, I'm using brown rice vinegar because it's mild. And then the honey gives the counterpoint to the vinegar for the sweet sour. So it's one part of honey, one part of brown rice vinegar, and two parts of real good organic mayonnaise mixed together. And I do the same thing that you do, thanks to my friend Ashley, who turned me on to the idea of putting a little tiny bit of onion in with the cabbage just to brighten the flavor, really grated very finely. And so, well, I'll think about adding that to the holiday table.
That's how I do my chicken salad, too, a little bit of grated onion.
But I'm going to finish that meal with the favorite pumpkin pie.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, we're back into the antioxidant land with the beta carotene. But there's also alpha carotene and cryptoxanthin and lutein and zeaxanthin. And right away, when you hear that list, you know that it's protecting the eyeball against macular degeneration.
That sounds like a really rich meal.
Well, when I have that pumpkin, I can eat it in a thousand different ways.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't have to just be pumpkin pie. There's pumpkin pudding. There's just steamed pumpkin done as a vegetable. But when we've got these rich sources of copper and calcium and potassium and phosphorus and vitamin B6 and thiamine and pantothenic acid and all kinds of good things, plus some iron and some niacin and some selenium and some zinc and our old buddy tryptophan again, All of these things are present in the pumpkin. So we might make a little bit of a healthier pumpkin simply by cooking up our pumpkin with some soy milk. And when we cook up our pumpkin with some soy milk, add a little splash of molasses into it. The soy milk has a thickening quality to it, just like dairy milk does. It can also be done with cow milk,
yes,
goat milk, sheep milk, whale milk, dog milk, possum milk.
Any mammal milk.
Any mammal milk. So what it will do is it will thicken that pudding, mm-hmm, and then it'll set up like pudding. And
yes,
so you don't always have to do it as a pie.
That's true.
So turkey and cranberries, sweet potatoes and green beans, pumpkin pie for dessert, and a little coleslaw on the side.
My daughter made a little dairy-free, gluten-free pumpkin cheesecake using tofu-based sour cream or cream cheese last Thanksgiving, and it was also delicious.
And I don't think I got a piece of that either.
Well, you're going to have to stop by.
Dr. Fred Harvey, internist, gerontologist, member of the American Board of Holistic Physicians, and our guest here on No Nonsense Nutrition on the third Monday of every month. Thank you, Dr. Harvey.